What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Barron's Live Market Watch Edition. I'm Jeremy Owens, tech editor and San Francisco Bureau Chief at Market Watch, and I'm subbing in for John Swartz, who's had some internet issues this morning. Today, we have Nabiha Syed, president at the Markup and Free Speech Lawyer. She's going to join us today to talk about antitrust and big tech. And we're going to lead off with Apple. And the reason we're really talking about Apple today, as well as Google a little bit, is because of a new law that just got passed in South Korea this week. That law will ban large app market operators like Apple and Google from requiring software developers to use their payment systems, which they do now to generate lucrative commissions of up to 30% on all digital sales within their apps. Now, a legal settlement by Apple with smaller developers last week will allow developers to direct consumers to payment options outside of the App Store, but not within their app. And there's an expected decision in Epic Games Inc.'s antitrust lawsuit versus Apple for many of the aforementioned issues. And with all of these storm clouds kind of coming around over Apple in the antitrust arena, we've decided to have Nabiha come in and help us out. She's president of The Markup, a new investigative journalism startup that explores how powerful actors use technology to reshape society. She's also a research fellow at Yale Law School, where her research projects include journalist security, anti-harassment measures, and new news gathering tools, such as drones, sensors, and data scraping. She co-founded the Media Freedom and Information Access Legal Clinic in 2009. Nabiha, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. What a fun set of topics for today.
Yeah, it's all coming together. We have some great John stories on the internet to get some background on this. But we're going to start off with the South Korea legislation, which passed yesterday. Now, what might that new law there mean for legislation in the U.S. and elsewhere? And more important, what does it mean for Apple and Google moving forward?
Oh, it's such a good question. So I want to zoom out and just say, I think we are in this fascinating moment of what I call regulatory imagination. Everyone's wondering, can we do that? What happens if we do that? What's the blowback going to be? What happens to the business? And so what's interesting with South Korea is that they decided to be the first movers on this issue that everyone's talking about in-app payments that developers around the world are saying really takes like their lunch money right out of their pockets. Because if you remember, if you think about, for example, take the EU, where the competition commissioner said that there were complaints from Spotify and others saying that the Apple tax, the 30% tax levied on any in-app payment within the Apple ecosystem, puts them at a disadvantage. Because remember, Apple Music doesn't have to worry about that 30% Apple tax, but Spotify does. So it puts them in this very different competitive vantage point. And that's tough for everyone whose businesses that are going through these few gatekeepers, whether it's Apple or Google. So everyone is sort of aware of the problem, whether it's South Korea leading the way in terms of action, the EU that's been thinking about this for a long time, but the sort of recent Apple Spotify issue as late as April. And in the US, you know, of the package of antitrust legislation that we saw earlier this year, one of the proposals is the Open App Markets Act that specifically speaks to this issue of in-app payments and how developers are locked into the ecosystem. So if I were Apple and Google, looking at the world, sort of everyone's waking up and realizing this is an issue, I'd be worried. I think this is all adding momentum to this moment, which makes legislation like the open app markets legislation even more likely. And I think that's why you see sort of efforts to try to limit the damage by settlements in different lawsuits and other things we can get into.
Sure, but in trying to craft that legislation, you run into some issues, right, that you don't want to make it too broad. And you talk about Spotify angry that it's competing on Apple's marketplace, but Apple gets to put its own solution out there. Mm-hmm. That they don't take the 30% off of because they get everything. But I think of something like Costco, right? Where mm-hmm. Costco allows other merchants or other sellers to put stuff in their store. They take a cut of it. But then they can also come in with their own Kirkland brand mm-hmm. and put that on the shelf. And they can see exactly like Apple can see what apps are popular and say, we want to make that app. And Costco can do the same thing. It can see what products are selling well in its stores, make its own Kirkland's brand, put that in the stores. So, you know, with that, I think lawmakers are watching out to not make these laws yep. too broad. Right. And not catch up all these other ancillary businesses that, as we discussed this week, are platforms just the same as these digital platforms are, because all they want to do is bring consumers and sellers together in one place.
I think that is the most important point. And that's why this sort of imagination moment is so tricky, because if the answers were easy, we would have them by now. The desire to like hit that perfect middle point where you can craft a rule that captures true gatekeepers of commerce, which I would argue Amazon, Apple, at least for the iOS market, Google Play for the Android market, capturing them, but not getting the Costcos of the world that simply are not gatekeepers of commerce quite in the same way that these big tech companies are, no matter how much I love Costco and go way too often to the one here in Brooklyn. You know, it is just situated differently. And I think that is the real challenge here. And you see efforts to sort of thread the needle in things like, you know, the language from the judge and the trial of the Epic Apple lawsuit, right? Those like final mm-hmm. few days of questioning from the judge really indicated this desire to see like, how can we minimize the harm and in a way that encourages competition, but doesn't totally destroy business models? Because, you know, courts aren't management consultants, so that's not their job.
Right. And with Apple and its business model, they obviously just had this settlement last week with the smaller developers. Now, there were two lawsuits in one courtroom under one judge, right? Mm-hmm. And this one was with smaller developers, those who generate less than $1 million in revenue per year on the Apple platform. Now, was the concessions Apple did merely a public relations play? Is there going to be severe change? Are these settlements that they made with the smaller developers going to actually affect large change in how Apple deals with them? Or is this just Apple finding what it could be comfortable with and wouldn't actually affect it and getting through with it?
It's the latter. Apple is the queen of PR, and this is a prime example. So if you know, first things first, $100 million in terms of a settlement sounds big, but it's a drop in the bucket when you think about a $64 billion revenue stream through the App Store worldwide. Also, the settlement's just for the US and not globally, so it's already sort of limited in terms of its large effect impact. But to me, the part that I thought was the most like chef's kiss to Apple, where I was like, man, this is such a smart play, is it actually just repackages a rule change they made back in June, right? So mm-hmm. in June, when they released their new App Store guidelines, they did say developers can reach out to users off platform via email, so long as they get in their specific express consent and people opt in. So just zoom out and think, what does that mean in practice, right? In practice, that means I'm a developer, I have an app. First, I have to email my users and say, hi, would you be open to receiving future emails from me that may have offers like 20% off a digital currency or 30% off your monthly subscription? They have to find my email in their messy inbox, say yes, and then I can send them those kinds of discounts, those incentives to, again, go off platform. That's a lot more friction than being able to advertise in-app or, hey, click through and just buy my, you know, Fortnite bucks over here. And that's still banned, right? The in-app advertising is still banned. So what Apple did was, yeah, is it a little bit of a concession? Is it a move? Sure. The amount of friction that's there, we'll see how effective this is for anyone who's actually going to avail themselves of it. But it's not the type of like radical change that I think it was heralded as by so many.
Right. And that radical change may come in the Epic Apple decision that is coming up here. Now that is the lawsuit that is more large developers versus Apple. Epic Games is the maker of Fortnite and really kicked off this with a huge antitrust suit against both Apple and Google separately. And the Apple decision is expected here in the upcoming days. The federal judge in the case in Oakland, California, right here where I am, is Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers. Now, she needs to affirm the legal settlement in the class action suit, but she's also weighing Epic versus Apple, what she heard in a lawsuit this summer, what she heard in a trial this summer, and she is expected to give her decision any day now. What might we anticipate from her in the Epic case? Will it be more radical? Could she try to end Apple's commission fees on large developers like Epic, Spotify, and Match, which gets Apple a lot of money and takes a lot of money out of those companies' pockets? Try to limit that. What could she actually do legally to Apple in that case?
So this case has been one to watch for so many. And I think one nuance that's lost on folks is that this is not the judge's first time at the Apple store. She's had several cases in the past 10 years that deal with Apple and developers as well as iTunes. And so you see that sophistication in her questions throughout the trial. I mean, she was really digging in to try to understand, is there a way to improve the situation for developers like Epic without totally eviscerating Apple's entire business model? And remember, the business model that Apple has through the App Store isn't like a new development that they created. That was it really, the App Store came about a year after the iPhone came out. So it's really been there from the start. And so she's asked questions like, what is the problem with allowing customers to have more information about better deals elsewhere, right? That was a question she asked in the trial. I think she is really looking to see where is the compromise here. Again, courts are not management consultants. I do not think that she's going to come and totally rewrite the entire business model, particularly one that's been there for so long for Apple. But I think she is going to be open. I think it's likely that we're going to see some kind of haircut. So I think, you know, for Apple, I don't really see her coming out and saying this is you're illegally using your monopoly position to do something here. I think it's more likely to say, you know, these anti-steering rules that you have preventing people from being steered off site or 30%, you know, like that seems excessive if what your interest mm-hmm. keeps saying is, oh, we're doing this for the privacy and security of the App Store. Really, you need 30% to do that? Like, could it be 15 like it is for some of your smaller businesses? Like, what's another number that makes sense here that's more fair? I think that is the most likely outcome we're going to see. I don't think radical change is necessarily coming from this case. But I think it's possible Apple wins the battle, but they lose the war, right? Because in Washington, the scuttlebutt right now is, from pro-business folks, is, you know, antitrust laws are there for a reason. They've been there for a long time. They will mediate the situation, respect the process, respect the time. If Apple keeps coming up golden, I think that might create some incentive on the legislative front to say these incremental changes, this little tweak here and there, it doesn't get to the core business model issue of this gatekeeper. We're going to do something about it. And that's what's interesting. So I think the radical change could come unintentionally out of this lawsuit if folks in Washington think it hasn't gone far enough.
Sure. And we are dealing with a lot of antitrust legislation in Washington. We are finally starting to see some movement, right? We have seen other countries in the state of California do their pushes to mm-hmm. try to rein in big tech a little bit. And now we're finally seeing some movement in Congress in terms of House bills. There's a new Senate bill that was introduced last week. What do you see from the proposed legislation that's looking to basically change antitrust law a little bit to address these? And why would they need to change antitrust law at all to address this new brand of big tech company?
I think a lot of it is met by this challenge of defining what the market is, right? So whenever you talk about monopoly, the first question you have to ask yourself is, what is the market that we're talking about? And then what is the harm? So if you can define the market in a broad enough way that or a narrow enough way, then you might be able to have some outcomes. And if your measure of harm is just, is the consumer harmed, right? A price-oriented set of outcomes, that also kind of limits, constrains your zone of activity. I think what's really interesting about a lot of these proposals is they're focusing on the competition question. They're focusing on opportunity cost. What are the innovations we are not seeing? Because these gatekeepers are 500-pound gorillas in this space. They either hungry hippo, all the smaller orgs that are there in light of business change. They inhibit them directly. They play shenanigans, you know, cutting off access to their APIs and things like that. How do you measure that opportunity cost? That's really tricky, right? And it's just mm-hmm. not clear to me that we have a body of law that is clear on some of those questions. So for example, to get specific, right? In thinking about that Epic Apple suit, to bridge back to that, you know, like the question of how you define that market is really interesting. Epic is saying the market there is iOS users, right? Like we mm-hmm. can't get to that market because Apple holds all of that. They're effectively arguing something really similar to what we saw with Kodak in the 1990s, where, and stop me if you know this, and if folks, this is obvious to them, but I thought this was fascinating and potentially instructive, right? So back in the 90s, Kodak created, you know, all their machines, and they decided that rather than incentivizing people to go to independent repair shops to fix it, they wanted to drive people back to Kodak repair shops. The Supreme Court said Kodak created an aftermarket, right? That repair market is an aftermarket there, and that's not allowed. They created this market, it's an aftermarket, and then they controlled that market. And mm-hmm. the reason we don't allow that is because once you have a Kodak printer, fax machine, whatever, you're not really going to throw it in the garbage. You're already locked in, right? So take that mindset and then look at Apple, right? Look at an iPhone. Once you have an iPhone in your hand, is it really fair to say, well, if you want something better, go to Android? No, you just spent $1,000 plus on this iPhone. You're kind of locked in, right? Mm-hmm. And so all of these sort of definitional questions are really murky because the precedent doesn't exactly fit on. So we're trying to find all these analogies to make them make sense. And that's why if we can get clear legislation, right, that says, let's just look at the issue we have now. Let's look at the issues that are possible because of the accumulation of data, which is not what we're talking about with Kodak, not what we're talking about these old antitrust mm-hmm. like Standard Oil cases. Let's talk about how data really changes the game here and creates a stickiness to markets and competitive advantage that other folks don't have. That's where the legislation gets really interesting. But it's
and still- I find the Kodak analogy extremely interesting because then it also gets into the right to repair that we're also dealing
exactly.
with now.
Exactly.
That you can't really get an Apple product, as Joanna Stern showed in the WSJ this week beautifully with a column and a video. Yep. You can't really get your Apple computer fixed at a decent rate by a third party. You have to go to Apple, which wants to charge you almost as much as it costs to get a new computer.
Exactly. Exactly. I have a toddler who enjoys spilling liquids on my laptop, so I'm well aware. So
you know the Genius Bar very well.
Yes,
yes.
I do.
Well, you know, we've spent a lot of time on Apple, so let's move on now, because Apple probably is not the one under the biggest spotlight from regulators. If I had to say one, I'd probably say Google. Do you have one of these big tech companies that you think has the biggest spotlight on it from regulators and especially from antitrust perspective?
I mean, I think it is absolutely Google, right? I think Google is facing bites at them from every corner of the world and every frontier, even the United States, right? Like in early July, we saw a lawsuit brought by 36 states in the District of Columbia, all on its App Store model. Of course, there's the epic Google case that, you know, mirrors the epic Apple one. Trial hasn't been scheduled there. There's the landmark investigation into search and alleged self-dealing on search brought by the DOJ, which is unfolding. I mean, these are big, big, interesting cases. So I think, you know, Apple's kind of having its month, you know, it's having a moment, but I think Google is where it's going to be really fascinating. And a story that we did at the Markup actually last summer was looking into, you know, how does Google drive people back to its own platforms when you search something? Like, for example, I have had occasion to search things like how much sand is too much sand for a 2-year-old to eat.
Yeah.
Google that, and you get a set of questions that when you click on them, again, it's just sending you back to more Google search oriented properties, juicing the entire system, making a lot of money for them, not really helping anyone else. And so I think that kind of scrutiny where people are realizing this is a full ecosystem where every piece of the Google ecosystem is helping it amplify every single other piece, that this is a behemoth, mm-hmm. not just like a little, like not just like an ad business and not just a search business and not just books, something big. And I think that's we're going to see a lot more to come in that space.
And regulators are tearing up every little bitty business within there, right? We've already
exactly.
seen Europe go after Google Shopping for putting its own links and for advertised links above mm-hmm. natural organic search. We've seen them go after Android for putting on Google Apps, forcing OEMs to use Google Apps if they use Android. So I think we're gonna continue to see that, and that's gonna be interesting. Now with Facebook, they have been targeted by the FTC. There was a lawsuit. The judge tossed that lawsuit out.
Mm-hmm.
They are winning, apparently, while Google is getting pounded from all sides. Facebook, the one real big attempt we've seen, has been tossed out right now. Now, the FTC has come back and revised that lawsuit and put it in front of the judge again. What do you think of that revised lawsuit that has been put forward by the FTC? Will that be enough to get this to go forward, or will Facebook be able to get that tossed out again?
I think this is going to trial. So when I read the first complaint, I have to say, I looked at it and I was like, I don't know if you did enough to answer that perennial question. What is the market? Like, before you get to monopoly, before you get to impacts, before you get to any of that, what is the market we're talking about here that's being dominated? And that first complaint didn't really do it. It just didn't do it. There also wasn't, I think, a really clear narrative of why this was happening. A narrative is always important in antitrust cases. When you look at historical ones that have been successful, a clear narrative of why a business is engaging in this strategy ends up being persuasive. When the FTC repled and in its new complaint, I think it went a long way in remedying both of those, right? So the FTC clarified that, okay, the market we're talking about here is personal social networking, not professional, which is LinkedIn, not TikTok, which isn't about personal. It's about just reaching other people that are interesting. It's much more like Snapchat, right? That's the other player in that market. And using Comscore and I think Facebook's own metrics, they pled that Facebook has 70% of daily active users, 65% of monthly active users, and 80% of time spent on personal social networking. Those are pretty bold numbers, right? For someone who's looking at dominating the market. And I think, you know, if Facebook wants to push back, these are going to be the types of issues of fact that you're going to see come up in a trial. Like, I'm just not convinced that you were going to see enough of that in the stages before in summary judgment. I think it's going to end up at trial.
And I think Snapchat is a perfect example also of how Facebook uses that power, because they attempted to buy Snapchat.
Exactly.
They failed. And then they basically copied everything that Snapchat was doing that consumers enjoyed and put it on their own platform and tried to take those people over there, right? So that's the narrative that they're going to tell in this case, is they only have one competitor, they've tried to buy it, they failed, and then they tried to kill it, right? And that's a compelling narrative to show exactly what they're doing in that sphere.
Yeah, and I think that's pitch perfect. I think what the complaint did in terms of that narrative was also explain the motives of why and when this started happening, right? So they were like, Facebook dominated desktop, and then here comes mobile. Here comes all these other ways of interacting on mobile that make WhatsApp, a mobile messaging app, a hell of a lot more persuasive and appealing. Instagram, mobile first. So the narrative is that as Facebook was looking at the market evolving to mobile, they wanted to remain the competitive behemoth that they were. And the way to do that was just to gobble them all up. And what's super interesting in the complaint is they talk about how, you know, they purchased a VPN, and through the VPN's data were able to identify what the most popular mobile apps were, and then they went and bought them. And that just, again, starts to become a really clear narrative of, oh, that's why you were doing it, to maintain this type of dominance. And that's something that we can wrap our minds around. I just think it wasn't there in the first complaint. It is now. So it's compelling enough that we'll see it go forward.
Yeah, and the FTC is making that complaint. While we're talking about the FTC, we should bring up the new chair of the FTC, Lina Khan. And she has a well-documented history of questioning the business practices at Amazon, which is the big tech company we have not discussed yet. Lina Khan made her name from a groundbreaking paper on Amazon and antitrust. But so far, Amazon has largely escaped the antitrust radar. Do you see that changing, and how do you see that moving forward if it does change?
Zero doubt. I have zero doubt that the FTC is going to come for Amazon. And I think even Amazon knows that, given that they're asking Chair Khan to recuse herself from any prospective lawsuit that may come. They haven't even filed anything, and Amazon's already scrambling to say, get her out. She can't be on it because of views espoused in the article that you mentioned. I think the hard question is what you touched on. What do they go after, right? Do we see clues in the Platform Anti-Monopoly Act? We saw a lot of commentary in one of the proposed legislations, a lot of proposals trying to crack down on businesses privileging their own products in their own marketplace, right? So Amazon Basics on the Amazon marketplace. Of course, that references the Costco point you made earlier, which is, how do you craft that rule without, you know, going after the Costcos of the world. In that same Anti-Monopoly Act, you see limitations on the use of data from third-party businesses, from merchants on the Amazon marketplace to inform, you know, new product lines. Will we see some investigation into that? Are we going to see something totally different, which is looking at sort of the preferred customer clauses that you see on Amazon? If you sign up to be a merchant on Amazon, some of those contracts often say you have to offer the best price to Amazon, meaning that if you're a merchant and you want to sell on your website and you want to sell in all these other places, the best price is always on Amazon. That's where people are going to go. It inhibits your ability to move to other marketplaces and build user bases and customer bases there. Any one of those could be something that the FTC decides to take on. It could be looking at the dominance of AWS and saying, are you operating like a utility? What's going on here? Because so much of the web is run on AWS. I don't know where it's going to go. I do think all the regulators and the legislators across the globe very clearly appear to be in some sort of conversation with one another. Even if it's not explicit, everyone's watching each other. So my guess would be that some of the things that we saw in the Anti-Monopoly Act proposal, that proposed legislation, might be what we'll see for Amazon. But that is going to, I think, because of the chair's background, I think that's going to be one where when they come, they're going to come correct. When you come at the king, you best not miss. And I think it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, and Amazon's already tried to get Lina Khan recused from their investigation. Look, we've got some audience questions, so let me get to that. We have a listener named Lee, who says he is an antitrust litigator and disputes any characterization that Apple has a monopoly, and asks, what market is its monopoly in?
I think this is the heart of the question that's interesting in the Epic Apple case, right? So what Epic's saying, okay, the market is iOS users, people who have an iPhone, they've bought it. You really can't go get apps otherwise unless you jailbreak your phone, right? And like, I'm an Apple user, I see other apps for other things, but I can't get them unless they end up on the App Store. So if you constrain the market to be iOS users, then yeah, Apple has 100% of that market, except for people who jailbreak their phone, which you're not supposed to, by the way.
But Costco also has a monopoly control over its own stores, exactly. Right? If you open a store, you can't say that's a monopoly of that type of store.
Exactly.
You know? And that's where it gets funky in that argument. Yes.
Exactly. And that's where I don't see Judge Gonzales-Rogers being like, this is a monopoly there. I think she's much more likely to say, okay, do you really need 30% here? Do you really? What's stopping you from allowing people to advertise in the app that there's something else that could be a cheaper price? And again, that is resonant with this idea of what we should be looking at is consumer benefit and price. And if she's using that lens to assess, you know, what can she really do here, then saying you should, the consumer is losing out if they're not receiving information that a cheaper price is available if someone goes somewhere else. So you got to let them run those ads if they're real.
Sure. And if you're looking at more of like a general app store market, then it's a duopoly, yep. Right? And I think that's one thing that's going to throw a lot of this into rears. I mean, we're dealing with an oligopoly right here, which mm-hmm. is the five big tech companies, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, basically are competing one-to-one in different markets within tech. Cloud is Amazon versus Microsoft versus Google. App stores is Apple versus Google, right? And that's what we're dealing with. And I think that's why we have to look for new law, mm-hmm. right? That antitrust law, the questioner brought up the Sherman Act and said, if you say Apple has a monopoly in the relevant market of its app store, you're basically undoing over 100 years of antitrust law under the Sherman Act. Right. The relevant market, he says, is smartphones. Well, in smartphones, smartphone operating systems, you have a duopoly in terms of Apple and Google. Right. So how do you manage that? Right. And that's the kind of thing we're going to be dealing with as we move forward, is do we allow these one or two companies who are interacting and discussing and have, you know, deals, right? Where Google pays Apple billions of dollars a year to be the core search function on the iPhone. So they're competitors, they're cooperators. That's kind of what these new laws and what the court cases are trying to deal with. Another question from Hal: why isn't this just sour grapes by app developers resorting to regulation to deprive Apple of its legitimate first mover advantage?
I mean, that's certainly a perspective, right? But the other perspective is the developers are saying, look, like there's just a couple of marketplaces where we know the majority of users exist. They're either on they're either on the App Store or they're on Google Play. Again, to your point of duopoly, that's where people are. And that's the only way we can reach them. And we're not saying that we should be, I mean, I guess there are some folks that are saying they should be charged nothing to participate in that marketplace. There's others who are saying, you know, fine to pay some cost of admission into the marketplace, but does it have to be 30%, which gives you such an edge that that's what starts to feel uncompetitive? And I think that is sort of this looming, interesting question. And I think actually that this is a question that we face not just in the antitrust around, you know, Apple and Google, but even in our conversations around speech platforms, which is we have marketplaces that were the result of serious innovation from big companies. Like the creation of the App Store is nothing to sneeze at. They invest serious money into that marketplace. What do you do when the marketplace for the larger economy converges into something owned by a single business? And once they're that kind of gatekeeper, do you think about whether they have a responsibility to deal more equitably with competitors there? Do we think the government should run an app store? Like the sort of bigger, these bigger creative questions of, okay, if you don't like this, how should it work? That's the layer that I think we're not getting at in the conversation. That's the area where I always want to talk to folks the most, which is like, okay, developers, like do you think the US government should run this? Who should run it? And if it's going to be a private company, don't we think that there should be some cost of doing business, even if it's not as big as, you know, the 30% Apple tax?
Sure. And Lee jumped right back with a comment saying courts aren't supposed to run markets. Competitors and consumers run markets. And that's where he disagrees about the Epic case, saying Apple has no actionable monopoly, period. Let's get one more question in here as we're right at the end of our time. Steve asks, what's the short-term versus long-term impact of these investigations and trials on these companies? Seems like these things will not happen overnight. So do you think they will be more medium to long-term impact? Now, I would like to dip in on that and say that we have written before about this generation of big tech coming up because of the monopoly and antitrust investigation into Microsoft in the early 2000s. While that didn't have that much of a short-term or monetary effect on Microsoft, it stalled them and pivoted their focus to the antitrust and allowed Amazon and Google to breathe. Right? They were not allowing, Microsoft was not doing a lot of M&A during those couple of years where they were dealing with that. They probably, you know, 3 years earlier would have gone hard after Google. Right, would have really tried to pick up Amazon maybe in its own backyard. Right, the government scrutiny, the government lawsuit, kind of held Microsoft back and gave breathing room to younger tech companies to grow. And now we're dealing with the next generation that has grown during that. But so we might see that. We might see short term a hampering of mergers and acquisitions and other activity like that, that could allow those companies that would normally be acquired by Facebook or Google or Apple to grow and foster competition. But we'll have to see. What do you think about that?
I think we'll have to see. I was actually going to bring up the Microsoft example, so I'm so glad that you did, right? Like they operate in an ecosystem. So if you're going to divert your attention to something else, what do you miss out on, right? Do you miss out on making potentially other more ambitious plays and you're not going to because you want to play it safe? The only counter to that I'll say is that like these are very large companies with very deep pockets. So will we see a ton of inhibition because of these investigations? I don't know. I think it's hard to predict. Now, one thing that I think is certain in the short to medium term is that you'll see efforts just like Apple's settlement with over the $100 million with this sort of small developer case. I think you'll see a lot of efforts by these companies to be like, okay, what can I do to stave things off at the pass? What's something quick that I can do that will help you know, reduce the temperature in the room. I think we're going to see a lot more of that, a lot more willingness to play ball, because if they don't, I think there is really serious momentum globally, whether it's the, you know, between the FTC, the DOJ, and the political sentiment in the US, the EU continuing it on its path, and then seeing other countries like South Korea, you know, nip at the heels of these companies. I think there'll be an effort to try to defray a full frontal assault globally. I don't know what the long-term effect of that's going to be, right? It just depends on whether they gain traction and gain momentum. We'll see.
Right. What I would say about that is follow Market Watch, John Swartz and myself, and we'll tell you what's happening the entire time and try to explain to you what it could have long-term. Thank everybody so much for joining us today, and especially thank you, Nabiha. We really appreciate you being here. Please check out the markup and everything that Nabiha is doing. And we will please join us tomorrow on Barron's Live, where we'll have Barron's Senior Managing Editor Lauren Rublin discussing with reporter Josh Nathan Kazis the outlook for pharma and biotech stocks and the COVID pandemic. Thank you so much again, Nabiha. Thank you so much to the listeners for checking in with us. And come back tomorrow and check out our antitrust coverage on MarketWatch. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you so much for having me.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.